Welcome to the Acromegaly Update for Monday, May 18th, 2026. Today we have two things for you. First, a look at the most important new research on acromegaly published in the last week, and then we'll zoom out to the broader rare disease industry for a handful of stories that matter for anyone following companies developing drugs for rare conditions. Let's get into the science. Segment 1. Acromegaly Research. The standout paper this week comes from Oslo and was published in the European Journal of Endocrinology. A group of Norwegian researchers used high-throughput protein profiling to hunt for novel biomarkers in acromegaly, going well beyond the standard growth hormone and IGF-1 tests that clinicians rely on today. They enrolled 37 patients and measured nearly 200 plasma proteins at multiple time points. Before treatment, after pre-surgical medical therapy with a somatostatin receptor ligand, and after surgery. The results are striking. 37 proteins were significantly different between active disease and disease control, and several of those correlated with growth hormone and IGF-1 levels. Perhaps more importantly, 5 proteins changed dynamically in response to somatostatin receptor ligand treatment, suggesting they might eventually serve as pharmacodynamic markers worth telling clinicians in real time whether a drug is working. The biological themes that emerged from the data centered on extracellular matrix remodeling and systemic inflammation, which fits with what we see clinically. Acromegaly is not just about growth hormone excess, but about downstream tissue changes that can persist long after biochemical control is achieved. This work won't change clinical practice tomorrow, but it is a meaningful step toward a richer picture of disease activity than GH and IGF-1 alone can provide. The second paper, also in the journal Pituitary, takes on a dimension of acromegaly that gets less airtime than the endocrinology, the psychological toll. An Italian group synthesized existing cross-sectional, longitudinal, and registry evidence and proposed what they call a longitudinal clinical phenotype for the psychological burden of the disease. Their core message is one that patients and their families already know. Achieving biochemical remission does not mean you are well. The authors describe 3 overlapping layers: impaired health-related quality of life that persists from the functional and somatic sequelae of years of excess growth hormone, emotional distress tied to the stress of diagnosis, treatment, and uncertainty, and in a subset, frank psychiatric morbidity that accumulates from years of chronic dysfunction. They specifically call out chronic arthropathy, treatment burden, and subtle cognitive difficulties as drivers that sustain poor psychological outcomes even after the tumor is controlled. The practical takeaway is a call for routine longitudinal psychological assessment as part of standard acromegaly care, not a one-time screen at diagnosis, but ongoing monitoring over the disease course. Third, a paper in Pituitary that is relevant to anyone acromegaly in tertiary centers. A Turkish group characterized 13 patients with immature PIT1 lineage tumors, a newly recognized high-risk subtype under the World Health Organization's 2022 pituitary tumor classification. What makes this directly relevant is that nearly 40% of their patients presented with acromegaly, and another roughly 8% had combined growth hormone and prolactin secretion. These are not typical acromegaly cases. Median tumor diameter was 28 millimeters, nearly 40% had invaded the cavernous sinus, and despite maximal surgical resection, nearly half had residual disease, with about a third requiring reoperation within 16 months. All cases showed cytologic atypia. The numbers are small, but the message is clear. When you are dealing with an immature PIT1 tumor, you are in a different category from the usual somatotroph adenoma, and outcomes with surgery alone are significantly worse. This is a classification most endocrinologists will encounter only occasionally, but it matters to recognize it early. Finally, a systematic review and meta-analysis from the journal Pituitary quantified the co-occurrence of intracranial aneurysms in pituitary adenoma patients across more than 5,000 cases. The pooled prevalence came out to around 4%, meaningfully higher than the general population, with even higher rates in women. This is not specific to acromegaly, but because growth hormone excess promotes vascular remodeling, and most acromegaly tumors are macroadenomas, the overlap is clinically worth knowing. The practical implication is careful pre-surgical vascular imaging in appropriate cases. Now, zooming out from acromegaly to the wider rare disease industry. Segment 2, Rare Disease Industry News. The biggest deal story this week involves Italian pharma company Angelini, which announced it will acquire Catalyst Pharmaceuticals for roughly $4.1 billion in an all-cash transaction. Catalyst is a Florida-based rare disease company with three approved drugs, including Firdapse, a treatment for Lambert-Eaton myasthenic syndrome, a rare neuromuscular disorder that disrupts the connection between nerves and muscles. The deal values Catalyst at a 28% premium over its 30-day average share price. For Angelini, this is a meaningful push into the United States market, building on its European neurology and rare disease work. For the broader sector, this is another data point that acquirers remain willing to pay significant premiums for companies with de-risked approved rare disease assets. The deal needs to clear standard regulatory review before closing. The second story this week is one of the most emotionally complex in the rare disease field right now. Astellas has resumed clinical trials of its gene therapy for X-linked myotubular myopathy, a fatal muscle-wasting disease that affects male infants. X-linked myotubular myopathy, sometimes called XLMTM, causes profound muscle weakness from birth. Most affected boys cannot breathe without a ventilator. The original Astellas-sponsored gene therapy program showed genuinely remarkable early results. Some children who had never breathed independently were able to do so after treatment. Some could even stand and walk with assistance. But the program was halted 5 years ago after several boys with pre-existing liver disease died from liver toxicity. Astellas has now redesigned the program with revised patient selection and safety monitoring and has received clearance to resume enrollment. This is a high-stakes restart for a community that has lived with both the hope of what this therapy can do and the grief of what went wrong the first time. The field will be watching very closely. Third, a study published this week by Encoded Therapeutics from a trial in Dravet syndrome, a severe genetic epilepsy affecting children, is sending a ripple through the gene therapy world. The study tested whether sirolimus, also known as rapamycin, which is increasingly used alongside gene therapies to suppress immune responses against the viral delivery vehicles, might come with a therapeutic cost. In the 21-patient pediatric trial, children who received sirolimus in addition to standard steroids appeared to have lower overall treatment benefit compared to those who received steroids alone. The finding is preliminary and the trial was small, but it has direct implications for other companies, including Sarepta and RegenxBio, whose gene therapy programs also rely on sirolimus-based immunosuppression. If the safety drug is blunting efficacy, companies will need to rethink how they design their immunosuppression regimens. Encoded is framing this as a heads-up to the field rather than a crisis, but it is a finding that demands follow-up. Finally, a brief but important disclosure from Capsida Biotherapeutics. The company acknowledged this week that it still does not know what caused the death of a child enrolled in one of its gene therapy trials last September. Capsida says its investigation has been hampered because the treating hospital declined to share tissue samples from the autopsy. The disclosure raises uncomfortable questions about data sharing obligations between trial sponsors and enrolling institutions after a serious adverse event, and it is likely to draw regulatory attention. This is a process issue as much as a science issue, but for rare disease companies relying on gene therapy, it is a reminder that the infrastructure around trial safety oversight is still catching up with the science. Looking ahead, the convergence of this week's stories points to a few things worth watching. In acromegaly, the proteomic biomarker work signals a push toward more nuanced disease monitoring, one that could eventually support better dosing decisions for somatostatin receptor ligands and newer oral agents. In the wider rare disease gene therapy space, the Astellas restart and the sirolimus safety efficacy trade-off together frame the central challenge of the moment. How do you make these therapies safe enough to give to vulnerable patients without undermining what makes them work? Those are questions the acromegaly research community will eventually need to answer too, as molecular approaches to pituitary disease can continue to mature. On the deal front, the Angelini Catalyst transaction is a reminder that the M&A environment for rare disease companies with approved assets remains strong, an encouraging signal for the pipeline companies working their way toward that milestone. That's the acromegaly update for the week of May 18th. We'll be back next week with the latest from the field.